This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanya.
And I'm Talia.
And we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Talia.
Hey, Tanya.
How are you today?
I am so splendid. How are you?
I'm doing great. I am excited to tell you the story today.
Are you really?
Of course. Okay. Don't I sound like it?
I don't know. It seemed a little strained, but now you do. So
awesome. Before I start this week's episode, I am just going to remind everyone to please subscribe or follow on whatever app you're listening to us on. And our story begins on January 14th, 2003. Peter Martinez was working as a security guard for a multi-million dollar home complex in the private beach community of St. Malo Beach in Oceanside, California.
Nice.
Around 2 a.m., he noticed headlights from a 2000 Oldsmobile stopped several houses from where his guard shack was. He noticed two people getting out of the car, and they were struggling to get something out of the trunk. It seemed pretty heavy from what Peter could tell, and he thought to himself that someone was trying to dump garbage in one of the dumpsters.
I'm pretty sure my first thought would be a body.
Right? I know.
But that's because we do true crime.
Pete went over to one of the guys who was about 6 feet tall, and the other one was smaller, so I'm going to refer to one as taller and smaller. And he asked the taller one, what was he doing? Like, what do you got there? This startled the smaller one, and he dropped the bag he was carrying, dropped it onto the ground. The guys told him that they were just dumping some trash, and he said, look, this is a private community. You can't dump your trash here. You need to get going. So the taller one said to the other, pick up the bag, let's get going. And as they were struggling to pick up the bag, Pete noticed the bag kind of resembled a body bag. He had been in the Marines for 25 years, and he recognized what a body looked like all wrapped up. Even though he couldn't see initially what was inside the bag, he watched as they hoisted this bag up, struggling to get it into the trunk, and that's when he noticed what he thought was a human foot dangling out of one side of the bag.
Oh, shit.
He shouted to them, stop, put the bag down, you know, freeze kind of thing, and he grabbed his pistol, which he pointed at them.
Wow.
I know. He's trying to, like, stop what's going on. The taller one yelled at him, you're just a security guard. Fuck you. And they got the bag into the trunk, slammed it, and they sped off.
Oh, that is totally something I would have said.
They didn't get away, however, before Pete managed to get their license plate number, and he called the Oceanside Police Department to report what he saw. Later that day, Orange County Sheriff's homicide investigator, Andre Spencer, was looking over a ravine off the Ortega Highway. He was responding to a call that someone had made where they reported what they thought were human remains in a field near mile marker 79. As Investigator Spencer used a pair of binoculars to scan the land over the ravine, he spotted a torso. It was about 170 feet away from him, and as he focused on it, he was sure it was the headless, handless torso of a white female who was only wearing panties. So she was missing her hands and her head. So I'm going to take you back in time and tell you some of the background of the story. Armando Batista immigrated from Belize to the United States in 1981. He worked as a handyman, and while he was on a job, he met a woman named Jane Osborne while she was a student at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. So we're in Wisconsin. She was 19 and taking classes to become a teacher. Jane was fluent in Spanish, and their romance blossomed over the next several months. Armando was excited to show her his hometown of Corozal Town, which was a lobster exporting community on the northern coast of Belize. While visiting his family, Armando and Jane got married, despite his family not really liking her. They thought she was uppity because she insisted that Armando rent a hotel room instead of staying with his family during their visit. His mother was especially hurt, but Armando wanted to do everything he could to make Jane happy. So he borrowed money from his mom to get the hotel room, as well as extra money to take Jane out to dinner and things on their trip.
Is it really that big of a deal that now the mom doesn't like Jing?
I know.
I'm just saying.
I don't know.
They wanted their alone time, you
right?
know what I'm saying?
I know.
To get married.
They just got married.
I wouldn't want that shit in my house.
I wouldn't want some newlyweds.
I know.
Jane wasn't really close to her family. She barely spoke with her mother, but she stayed in communication with her dad and her sister. When she and Armando returned to Wisconsin after their trip to Belize, her father picked them up from the airport. Her father, James, came from a family that was relatively well off, but that didn't mean Jane benefited a lot from the family wealth. The newlyweds struggled financially at the start of their marriage, even though Armando worked hard to find work as a handyman. Jane continued to go to the university, but she never graduated because she had to work. Armando and Jane ended up in the Hickory Manor Apartments, which was a low-income housing complex, and Jane eventually found work at a nearby electrical plant in Waukegan. After being married about 8 months, Jane found out she was pregnant, and her first son, Jason, was born on August 25th, 1982. It's not very long after when they met, either. I mean, they've probably only known each other less than a year and a half. Jane didn't have very many friends at this point. She lost touch with a lot of her high school friends, but shortly after Jason was born, she reached out to an old friend named Joyce. She was excited to connect with Joyce because Joyce was also married and had a young family. She was actually a stay-at-home mom, and she babysat for Jason when Jane went back to work because she and Armando worked outside of the house. It didn't last long, though, this babysitting arrangement, because one day Jason got a diaper rash, and that was it.
What do you mean that was it?
Jane didn't want her watching Jason anymore.
Oh, okay.
Jane and Armando's marriage was a struggle, as I've mentioned, financially, but it also wasn't all love and sunshine and roses. Unfortunately, they got into lots of screaming matches with one another. In August 1983, Jane left Armando.
Wow, that wasn't very long.
No, it wasn't. And she moved into another low-income apartment in the same town. Armando begged Jane to come back to him and told her he couldn't live without her and their family. Jane didn't want to go back, but Armando told her he wasn't going to take no for an answer, and he would just beg and plead with her regularly, asking her to come back with Jason so they could be a family. On the afternoon of April 7th, 1984, Jane noticed Armando's car sitting in the parking lot at the electric company she worked at. She pulled her car up next to him, but she didn't see him in the driver's seat. She parked her car and she walked around to his, looking through the windows. That's when she saw Armando. His body was slumped to the side and his head was resting on the passenger seat.
No, he killed himself.
Mm-hmm. She noticed there was blood on his chest and she hurried to the passenger door, flinging it open, reaching inside to shake Armando. When she opened the door, she noticed a handgun laying on the floor of the passenger seat. She completely freaked out and ran to the security office, telling them what happened. They called the police, and by the time they got to the scene, they observed that Armando was dead and his blood had completely soaked through the seats. They determined he had been there at least 3 hours prior to them being called because rigor had set in.
Wow, he wasn't playing around when he said
no,
that.
No, he wasn't.
Wow, that's really sad.
I know. He left behind a 2-page suicide note blaming Jane.
Oh, man,
yeah.
Come on.
In the note, he told her over and over again that he couldn't live without her. He wrote, quote, "I wish you the best and all the happiness in the world to you and Jason and to all my family and loved ones. My earthly belongings belong to you and Jason. Living without you is as good as being dead. I've come to terms with myself and the fact that I'll never live happy without you," end quote. He ended the note by saying, quote, "You're all I ever wanted," end quote.
All he wants is her happiness, but he certainly found a way to make her feel like shit.
Right? Terrible. I can only imagine, right? The fucking guilt.
Guilt, right?
Right? Jane kept in contact with Armando's sister, who lived in Illinois, even though his sister pretty much hated Jane because she blamed Jane for Armando's death. However, for Jason's sake, she tolerated Jane and would invite her over for dinner occasionally with Jason. During one of these visits, Jane met a man named Jose Montejo. Soon, Jose and Jane were in a relationship, and he moved in with Jason and Jane within 3 months of them meeting.
She doesn't like to waste time with men, does
she? No, she doesn't. Jose realized that Jane had a really bad temper and her moods would swing wildly. She often cried to him, telling him she needed help, but Jose didn't know what to do. Jane hated Armando, and Jose noticed she would take her frustration out on little Jason. He noticed that if he paid attention to Jason, Jane would get mad. He didn't understand why she did this, but realized that because she hated Armando so much, she also hated the son she had with him. Jane was never really affectionate with Jason, despite him just being a toddler. So to compensate, Jose would pay more attention to Jason. When Jason was about 3, he was still wetting the bed, and Jane was really embarrassed by this.
That's not, I mean, I know. He's three. Okay still.
I know, and every time he woke up with wet bed sheets, she just spanked the shit out of him, and this made Jose crazy. Jose's father was an abusive alcoholic, so it just reminded him of his own childhood. When he tried to reason with Jane to get her to stop, she'd fly into a rage and tell him it was none of his business how she raised her son. Things got so bad that Jose decided he had to leave. And just before he was going to, Jane found out she was pregnant.
Oh, snap.
I know. Damn. Jose asked Jane to marry him before the baby was born, but she turned him down because she believed that the Social Security benefits she received for Jason would end. Jose and Jane's son, Matthew, was born on July 4th, 1987. So there's about a 5-year age difference between the two boys. Jose noticed a completely different Jane when they brought little Matthew home. She was extremely affectionate and was always hugging and kissing the baby and cuddling him in ways she'd never done with Jason. Jason was always on the receiving end of her wrath, even though he was just a little boy. For example, one time Jane had made 5-year-old Jason lunch, and part of it was a glass of milk. While he was eating his lunch, he knocked over the glass on accident. When Jane noticed, she grabbed him by the shoulders and spanked him with all her might. I mean, he was constantly, every little infraction, she got pissed at him about. Jane had never fully confided in Jose about what happened to Armando, and one day she finally told him. Up until that point, Jose didn't know that Armando committed suicide, and Jane confessed to him that in the weeks leading up to his death, she and Armando fought like cats and dogs. Jane told him she was working a late afternoon shift at her job at the electric company when Armando drove to the parking lot. Somehow he got her attention, and he called her over to ask her if she would talk to him. She got into his car, and during their talk, Armando pulled out a gun and shot himself in the chest right in front of her.
Well, that's a little bit different than what you told me.
I know.
Hmm.
Jason was in the car, too, because Armando was watching him while Jane worked.
Jason was in the car?
Yes. When he shot himself, Jane took little Jason out of the car and ran to her car and drove home. She was frantic. She didn't know what to do. I mean, she was completely freaked out, right? And eventually she came back to the parking lot, told the security that she found Armando in the car like that.
Why would she do that?
I know.
I'm sure you're going to tell me.
No. Oh. I don't know why.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Hmm.
I mean, other than she freaked out.
Hmm.
I can't imagine nobody else was there. But nobody else was there. It didn't get reported until she reported it. After learning the story, Jose realized that because Jason reminded her of Armando and brought up her bad memories, that's why she was really cold to her son. I'd mentioned Jane wasn't close to her family, and in the 1 year that Jose had been with Jane, he only saw her parents a total of 3 times. She blamed a lot of things on her parents, like, for example, she blamed them for her asthma because they were both smokers, which might have contributed to it. I don't know.
Well, we got to blame somebody for our problems. Exactly. We certainly can't blame ourselves. So right. Parents are the best thing.
Yes, parents are the perfect targets. In January 1988, she visited her parents, and when she came home, she was in a terrible mood. She told Jose that she was never going to see them again, and she ranted and raved about how much she hated them. While she was telling him this story, she picked up Matthew and then dropped him. Jose was shocked.
On purpose?
Yeah, she had never acted or treated Matthew this way, and remembering how she treated Jason, Jose was afraid that Jane was starting to take her anger out on Matthew. He jumped up and grabbed Matthew and told Jane that if she ever did it again, he was going to beat her ass, and he slapped her in the face.
Oh, okay.
I know. They struggled with one another, and Jose grabbed Jane by the throat and threw her on the ground. Jose stormed into the kitchen to get away from her and to try to calm down, but Jane was too angry to let him go. She went into the kitchen and she grabbed a knife and she threatened to kill him before he left her. Like, you're not going anywhere. I'll kill you before you leave, is basically what she said to him. A neighbor must have called the police, and Jose was arrested for assaulting Jane and was taken to jail.
Even though she pulled a knife on him.
I know, right? But he smacked her.
Where are the children during this confrontation?
This is all going on in front of the kids. A few months later, Jane filed a petition to have all the charges dropped against Jose, which was granted, but their relationship was pretty much ruined by that point. Jose didn't want anything to do with her, but he didn't want to abandon Matthew, so he tried to work things out with her.
And he probably didn't want to abandon Jason either, but he has no legal authority over him.
Exactly. I'm sure, because he did care for Jason. Jane became a stay-at-home mom, and Jose worked full-time to try to make the best life he could for his family. Jane soon told Jose she didn't want to stay in Wisconsin and felt they needed a fresh start due to the many problems they had been having. The family went to Florida on vacation, and when it came time for them to go home, Jane didn't want to go. They ended up taking an extended vacation in Florida for a month before Jose could convince her to return to Wisconsin. He's like, I got a job and shit, right?
I'm just thinking, doesn't there bills they got to pay?
Right.
She's like, no, I'm going to stay.
Yeah, no, I'm going to stay.
I mean, I felt like that on trips to Florida, too. You can't make me go back.
Yeah, why don't we just start a new life here? Luckily, Jose was able to get his job back when they returned to Wisconsin, but by then, Jane was convinced they needed to move somewhere else. This time, she set her sights on California, and Jose relented. The family packed up all of their belongings and headed to San Diego at the end of 1988. When they reached California, they settled in San Marcos in an apartment. Jose found work as a tire technician, and Jason was enrolled in first grade.
Where is San Marcos?
It's close to San Diego.
Nice.
I think it's maybe like a half an hour away.
That's a nice area.
Oh, yeah. Sunny skies. That's all I think of when I think of like San Diego, is sunshine.
And blue ocean.
Mm-hmm. Jose had hoped that Jane would be happy. You know, now that we've settled, we've moved, look. But Jane started to just do weird things. Like one of them was she made the family only eat a strict diet of lettuce and vegetables.
What?
I can't survive
Fuck
on that.
That.
Jose noticed she was still only giving affection to Matthew, which really bothered him. And his patience with Jane came to an end in the early 90s. By then, Jane accused Jose of cheating on her. And she would obsessively go through his dresser drawers and his pockets when he came home from work. Jose wasn't cheating on her, but one day he had brought a phone number of a male coworker home, and she found it in his pocket. And she's like, what the fuck is this, right? Whose number is this? The two men had struck up a friendship at work, and they were going to get together sometime outside of work. But when Jane found the number, she called it. When a woman answered, she flipped balls. I know. Jane started a fight with Jose by grabbing a knife in the kitchen.
Well, there she goes again.
I know, with this fucking knife. And she started just stabbing his clothes and tearing holes of them, shredding everything. Jose decided, okay, I've had enough. And instead of fighting back, he packed his things and left. Jane told him that if he left, she was going to call the cops and tell them that he was sexually abusing Matthew.
What is going on, Jane? Girl. She is losing it.
Mm-hmm. They did have a brief reconciliation, but due to the volatile relationship they had, it eventually ended when Jose went to jail after he and Jane had a physical fight. He pled guilty to a felony spousal abuse charge.
Felony.
Yes.
Ooh.
And was sentenced to a year in jail and a $100 fine. Jose never saw the boys again, and the day before he was released, he called Jane, but the number was disconnected.
He never saw the boys again?
Mm-mm. With Jose out of the picture, Jane was on her own with her two boys. Even though she didn't talk to her family, she still talked to her grandmother, Charlie May. Charlie May would send monthly checks to Jane that helped support the family, and she did that for years, I'm just going to tell you. Jane found housing for the boys and her, but the neighbors always thought she was a little off. They felt like she acted like she was better than everyone else, and they noticed she didn't have many friends. She also became target of much of their gossip. For example, she was usually home most of the day, but would always go out in the evenings around 8:30.
What was she doing?
Well, I don't know. She sometimes wouldn't come home until the early morning hours, and when she went out, she was dressed in like short leather skirts and fishnets.
She's hoeing around?
The neighbors nicknamed her Trixie.
Oh.
And they were convinced she was like a high-priced call girl at night, but I never found out what she was actually doing. So that's just rumor and speculation. She could have been just dating and not coming home, but I don't know.
Not judging.
Not judging. Not judging at all.
She was hoeing around.
Good for her. If she was, good for her. Besides this behavior, like the neighbors focusing on what Jane was doing, they also noticed how she treated the boys. On one instance, a neighbor named Rosemary saw Jason sitting on the curb outside his house, and he was crying. She went up to him to check on him, see if he was okay, and she asked him, "Why are you crying?" Jason told her he couldn't get inside his house, and Rosemary thought he had locked himself out. However, during their conversation, she found out that Jane was home and that she had locked him out of the house because he had made her angry.
I've wanted to do that a few times myself to my children. I haven't.
Just get out!
But I've wanted to.
Before I tell you more, we're going to take a break. In 1995, Jason began to suspect that his mom suffered from some kind of mental illness. He was only about 13. Earlier that year, they had a huge fight. He bought a pack of cards for that game, Magic the Gathering.
No idea. Have you ever heard of
that? Uh-uh. It's like a card game that kids play. There's characters on the cards, kind of like Pokemon has characters on the cards. I don't know much more than that about this game, but the pack of cards had only cost Jason a dollar. When Jane found the cards, she flew into a rage when she realized that Jason had bought them because he wasn't supposed to have any money. How could he afford a dollar for these cards when he didn't have any, so he must be stashing money somewhere? During their confrontation, Jane grabbed a belt and she snapped it at him. The tail end of the belt caught him in the eye, which eventually formed a bruise. During that same year, in the summer, Jane took the boys to Las Vegas, which is only about a six-hour drive from their home in San Marcos. Toward the end of the trip, Jason had turned on the television and saw the musician Duncan Sheik performing his hit song, Barely Breathing. Remember that song?
Yeah, I am barely breathing.
Yeah, that song. Okay. I'm glad you know it.
Of course I do.
It was a great song, right?
Still is.
Jane stood in front of the television as if in a trance. She pulled Jason aside and said, "I have a secret." She told him she had met Duncan Sheik one night in a bar, and now he was singing a song that she wrote. She was incensed, girl, that he was getting rich off of a song that he had stolen from her, and now he wanted to kill her over it.
Now he wanted to kill her?
Yeah.
Duncan Sheik?
Duncan Sheik wanted to kill Jane.
Oh.
And she tells this to Jason. Over the next several months, Jane tried to get in contact with Duncan Sheik. She was convinced music industry executives were spying on her.
I'm having a hard time taking you seriously right now.
Okay. I know. And she stopped going out in the daytime, wholeheartedly believing that Duncan's people wanted her dead. She stopped using cell phones and spent hours researching the singer. She bought his CDs and read the inside cover from back to front, searching for clues for ways that she could get in contact with him.
Well, she clearly has a paranoid personality disorder at the very minimum.
Yes, definitely.
With some sort of mood disorder added in.
That she wasn't being treated for.
Clearly she's not well.
No. She found Duncan's management firm in Boston and called and told them she was an old friend of Duncan's and asked that her phone number be passed on to him. Of course, Duncan had never met Jane, and because he didn't return her call, she told people he was deliberately trying to avoid her because he couldn't admit that he ripped off her song. As you just mentioned, her paranoia went into full force that year. She had a very long list of people she believed wanted her dead, and her focus grew to encompass entire ethnic groups, particularly focusing on Mexicans and Jews. She told her neighbors that someone was hiding in her backyard and stalking her. At first, they believed her because she was acting so genuinely terrified. She even called the police, telling them someone was in her backyard hiding and stalking her, but they never found anyone. In spring of 1996, Jane called a neighbor of hers, Paula, and begged her to come over. She told Paula and her boyfriend, Brian, that there was someone in her backyard and that it was one of those quote-unquote illegals. The pair ran over to Jane's house because she was so frantic and they searched. They didn't find anyone, even though Jane insisted by pointing to a bush and saying, "Can't you see? This is where he's been living. He sleeps under that bush."
Probably Duncan Sheik.
Yeah. Right?
Sorry.
Poor Duncan Sheik was getting these phone calls. Paula and Brian left, and Jane would call them many times over the next several months, only for Brian to come and search for some non-existent person. Jane's descent into mental illness really affected Jason and Matthew.
Oh, I bet. I'm sure it's embarrassing, too. Oh, and they are receiving the brunt of it.
Yeah, they are living with her. She moved them constantly all over Southern California. She always thought people were stalking her. She accused neighbors of being child molesters, or she was convinced that it was the Jews or Mexicans that were out to destroy her. It was always someone or something that was lurking in the shadows, ready to get her. When she moved the boys, they would sometimes stay in hotels for long stints of times or a new apartment every few months. Jason tried to keep things as normal as he could for Matthew, and they would get some peace when Jane would leave them alone. But if they were outside when she returned, she would yell at them to get inside because of the paranoia she experienced. When she got them inside the house, she would tell them that they were just like their good-for-nothing fathers and they would grow up to be losers just like their dads. The hatred that Jane had for Armando was still brimming on the surface. She would scream at the boys, especially Jason. And Jason would never yell back or fight back. He would just stay passive during her tantrums.
Well, can you imagine if he did yell back and fight back?
Oh, I know.
She would just explode.
Oh, she would. During one of the tirades that she had against Jason and Matthew, during one of these tirades, a neighbor recorded Jane and a call was placed to Child Protective Services. They paid a visit to Jane, and when she answered the door, she told the woman to get the fuck off her property, and the woman left, and CPS never followed up again.
Well, she seems totally fine.
Yeah.
Totally fine parent there.
I know. Despite the turmoil at home, Jason was a very good student. He excelled in high school. While Jason focused on his studies, Matthew tried to lose himself in sports, especially hockey. He was able to join a team in Riverside, and he did catch Jane, like, during a moment of lucidity where she was able to give him, like, the permission so he could join the team. And these periods of lucidity would last for a few months at a time. She was still able to cook and do laundry, pay the bills. Early in the season, Matthew's team asked him often to spend the night at or hang out at one of the boys' house off the ice, but Jane always said no. And so the invitations began to taper off. Jane would show up to the practices, and the other parents began to notice her odd behavior. She told them the reason she looked tired all the time and was so pale was that she had made some really bad business deals, and now people were trying to get back at her. She told the hockey parents that there were some very powerful people in the entertainment industry that were after her.
Oh, stop it.
And even though her story sounded crazy, she was very convincing. Almost believable, but not quite.
That's because she believed it.
Mm-hmm. One of the fathers confronted her about it once and said, "Well, who are these people that you're talking about? Who's doing this to you? Maybe we can help." Jane responded without missing a beat by looking down at his shirt and saying, "Let me just say you're wearing his clothes." The dad looked down at his Ralph Lauren polo shirt and said, "Really?
Really?
Really, Ralph Lauren's really after you? It's Duncan Sheik, it's Ralph Lauren." Things got so out of control that Jane accused the other parents of turning against her and that the people that were after her got to them.
Oh.
I mean, she's mistrusting everyone.
Wow, she is so paranoid.
Very. In the fall of Jason's 1998-1999 school year, his guidance counselor met with him and told him he had enough credits to graduate high school a year early if he wanted.
Good for him.
Mm-hmm. 16-year-old Jason was ecstatic. He thought, "Oh, this is awesome. I can start my college career early.
And get the hell out of the house."
He had set his sights that he eventually wanted to go to Harvard Law School. The only thing that was preventing him was getting a signature from Jane to allow him to graduate early. However, when Jason presented it to her, she signed it saying she had graduated a year early from high school, so she was all for it. Jason was excited to leave high school because he was teased and bullied a lot despite being 6 foot and 210 pounds. He had a very timid demeanor. He's kind of nerdy, and therefore he was the butt of a lot of jokes. As a graduating senior, Jason got to choose a quote to put under his picture in the yearbook. And his quote read, quote, "I, Jason Bautista, of unsound mind and lacking common sense, wish goodwill to few people. Instead, I wish bad luck, a lifetime of it, on a lot of people, and laugh at the stupidity of the rest," end quote.
They published that?
I know!
What? I don't know. I think they were probably looking for something more inspirational.
I know, right? What? Like, life is a journey, not a destination, and that kind of shit, right?
I can't believe they put that in there.
I know.
And what's going on with Jason? That's pretty dark.
That's what I thought. After graduating, Jason was accepted at the California State University at San Bernardino, which was only about a 30-minute drive from where he was living, which meant he could commute and still live at home with Jane and Matthew, so he did not get out and go away to college. Remember I told you Matthew plays hockey? Jane wouldn't allow him to be part of the hockey team photo because she said that Matthew's father was a very important person in Hollywood with lots of money, and he was trying to find Matthew.
Poor Matthew.
I know.
I'm just thinking, how humiliating.
Right? Right?
As if being a teen isn't hard enough to be a teen with a crazy mom.
I know.
Damn.
She said that if Matthew's father ever found him, she would never see him again. Jane's behavior got so bad that the coach of the team broke the news one day that Matthew was being removed from the team. The coach made it clear that his removal had nothing to do with Matthew and had everything to do with Jane.
Why isn't anybody trying to help these children?
I know, right?
Call CPS again and again and again until they finally get her the help.
I keep saying I know, but yeah, exactly. She does need help and these boys need help. He was removed from the team because Jane would come to the practices and just argue and yell at the other parents during the games and the practices. He was crushed by this news and he started to cry. When Jason found out about it, he was just pissed. He told Jane she was crazy and he finally confronted her. He was fed up and he just couldn't take it anymore, but Jane wasn't going to take that kind of language from her son. She asked him, "Who's gotten to you? You're on their side." Jason said, "Nobody is out there that's gotten to me, and you're just crazy." Jane was so angry, she ran into the kitchen, and what did she do?
She got a knife.
Of course. And she pointed at him, demanding to know who got to him. Jason noticed Matthew's hockey equipment and grabbed the stick to defend himself. Jane wasn't intimidated at all by Jason's decision to fight back, and she grabbed the hockey stick away from him, and she dropped her knife. She swung the stick at Jason, hitting him in the head hard, which ended up cutting him pretty badly. Blood poured from the wound in his head and he needed stitches, so he went to the hospital. Jane warned him, though, if he told anyone what was going on or started any trouble, that he would be sorry. So instead of telling the doctors what really happened, he made up a story and said he was playing around with his little brother and got whacked in the head on accident. Over the next couple of years, Jason took college courses, and I'm saying years, like it was probably until he was about 19. Okay, that's how long he was in college. Jason took college courses, Matthew continued in high school, and Jane would go from being stable to being frantic. She would have the boys living with her in an apartment, and then she would back out and have them move to hotels or living in their cars. Like, Jason had a car of his own, it was pretty much a piece of shit, and she also had a car, so sometimes they would sleep in their cars. Her grandmother was still sending her checks, and God only knows if she got any other money to live on, but they managed to have enough money to be able to move frequently. The life became quite unstable, again, for Matthew and Jason just begged Jane for them to please get an apartment and just settle down. The wandering they did became so erratic that sometimes Matthew couldn't attend high school 5 days a week, and Jane was just fine with that. She decided his safety was more important to her, and it was okay with her that he didn't go to school. She finally enrolled him in a homeschool program in San Bernardino County. Matthew wasn't the only one having trouble with school because Jason's grade point average fell so dramatically that the university put him on academic probation. If his grades didn't improve by the next quarter, he would be suspended and his lifelong dream of attending Harvard Law School would be flushed down the toilet.
If you're on probation already, you for academic
yeah,
you ain't getting grades, in. You're not getting into Harvard, no. But okay. We'll let him dream.
Yeah, still. You're going to have to go to the University of Detroit.
Where you can get a fine degree like
yes,
Tanya
like
did.
Yes, like I have. There's no Harvard for me. For all of 2001, Jane refused to even look at an apartment. And that entire year, the family either slept in their car or in hotels for days here and there. For Christmas 2001, Jane did get a hotel room in Corona, and Jason was so frustrated that he told her he was going to move out. He had been working and managing to save some money. He thought he'd be able to make it on his own. The next day, Jason packed up all of his belongings and drove away. He made one mistake, though, by taking the car that his mother always drove. He took the nicer car. That evening, Jane showed up to his job and took the car, leaving Jason stranded. He had to bum a ride from a coworker in order to get to school. He wasn't able to get a ride to his job, and he only lasted a couple days out on his own, finally caving in, calling Jane to come get him. She taunted him when he came back by telling him she knew he wouldn't last out in the world alone without her. Jason was so fed up. He was at the end of his rope. All he wanted to do was get away from Jane and go to school. His desperation turned into thoughts of murdering her. He mentioned this to Matthew by remarking, he wished Jane was dead. Okay, Matthew, I wish Mom was dead.
He's trying to see what kind of a reaction he'd get from Matthew.
Yeah, he's tossing it out there. Matthew didn't respond. Jason continued by asking his brother questions like, wouldn't it be great if we got rid of Mom? Wouldn't life be so much easier without her around? Matthew laughed it off because, of course, that's what I would do, right? Nobody thinks that anybody's serious.
Yeah, for real.
And Matthew said, yeah, life would be easier, but it wouldn't be great if she was killed. After Jason tried to leave home, Jane's grip on reality stabilized a bit. Jason used it as an opportunity to try and talk her into getting the family an apartment. They had been staying in a Corona hotel for several weeks. Again, I mean, I can't tell you, this went on constantly, in and out of apartments, hotels, everything. I can't even imagine how these kids had a normal life. They didn't.
And Child Protective Services thinks it's absolutely cool that they don't have a home.
I know. That's what I don't get. Jason begged his mom, saying, my grades are bad, and Matthew really needs to be around kids his age. He needs to get back into school, and he finally convinced her. After they spent a year and a half without a permanent home, they moved into an apartment, and the boys were overjoyed. As they settled into their new apartment, Matthew attended high school, and Jason declared biochemistry as his major. Jane wouldn't let the boys get cable television or internet, so Jason spent a lot of time at college in the computer lab, so much so he eventually got a job working there. He occasionally brought Matthew with him to the lab, and Jason would download his favorite TV shows such as That 70s Show, The X-Files, and The Sopranos so that they could go home and watch them later. The apartment that the family lived in was decorated pretty sparsely. There were no mattresses in any of the bedrooms, and instead the family slept in sleeping bags on the floor. They had televisions, but as I mentioned, there was no cable. They had no phone or couches. But despite not having much in the apartment, the boys were very happy because they at least had some stability. But as you know, all good things come to an end. And starting in October 2002, Jane informed Jason that the man next door was a pedophile. And he's like, oh, fuck, here we go again. I know that's the reaction he had.
My thing is, none of her sons are small children anymore, right?
Right.
Jason's like 20 now?
He's got to be like 19. He's probably somewhere between 18 and 19 years old. Jason just knew her mental health was in the decline. He knew to ignore her, but she kept insisting that the man next door was coming to get her and Matthew. I mean, I don't know if a pedophile would really be interested in her. Jason tried to reason with her and told her he doesn't want to hurt you or Matthew. Pissed that he didn't believe her, Jane accused Jason of being a child molester and of molesting his brother while she was out. In November, Jason told Matthew, we need to make a decision. He told his brother that Jane needed to be gone, and since she didn't have any friends and rarely talked to her family, no one would really miss her anyway. They could continue to cash grandma's checks, and Jason was working, earning about $2,000 a month, and therefore they could stay living in the apartment even if Jane was gone. Matthew listened as Jason went on, and he got really scared when Jason told him that he was going to need Matthew's help in killing Jane. Jane was very strong, and in order to kill her, Matthew was going to have to hold her down. Matthew completely refused, saying, I can't do that, and I can't help you, but I won't stand in your way. Jason said, okay. The plan he came up with was he was going to get Jane all riled up in an argument, and he would fight back this time. And when things started to get a little crazy, Matthew was to go into another room and Jason would take care of Jane.
I thought he needed Matthew to hold her down.
Well,
plans changed.
Yep, plan changed. On the morning of January 14th, 2003, Jason showed up to a study group at the university. He had a biology test later that day. He went to the computer lab for his job and he stayed at school pretty much all day, getting home about 7 p.m. Jane was cooking some pasta in the kitchen, and Jason sat in front of the TV with Matthew, watching Matthew play video games. After about 10 minutes, Jane started complaining again about the pedophile neighbor. She insisted this man's picture was in the newspaper. And Jason was just like, you know what, just leave me alone, and I don't really want to hear any of it. Jane got really angry that Jason was trying to blow her off, and they got into an argument. She threatened to kick him out, and she went into his room and grabbed a suitcase and started putting his clothes in it. He said, you can't throw me out. My name's on the lease.
That's a valid point.
Right? I mean, hello, I can do whatever I want. He screamed at her and said, fine. So, you know, started packing his clothes too. You know, you can just imagine this chaotic scene. The fight grew louder and louder, more intense. And when this happened, Matthew went into his mother's bedroom and closed the door. In her room was her little dog. I didn't mention it before, but she had a little dog. And so he sat with the dog for about 10 minutes, petting it and trying to forget the chaos that was happening in the other room. He eventually turned on the TV that was in his mom's room and just turned up the volume really loud, and he sat there with the dog. After about 15 minutes passed, Matthew heard a really loud thump and everything got quiet. He didn't leave the room, though, and stayed staring at the TV, holding the dog, not knowing really what to do next. In the other room, Jason stood over Jane's body after he had knocked her to the floor, and then he strangled her to death with his bare hands. After she stopped moving, Jason went into the bedroom to get Matthew. Matthew realized that Jane was dead, and when he made this realization, he was shocked that he didn't feel anything. Like, he expected to be more upset. Matthew asked Jason, well, what are we going to do next? Jason said, well, we're going to have to take care of it just like they did on The Sopranos.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Jason was referring to an episode where Tony Soprano dismembered someone that he had just killed. Like, yeah. He chopped off the head and the hand so that you couldn't identify the body. Matt shuddered and told Jason, I need to go outside and have a cigarette. We got to pump the brakes here. Jason used that time to go to the grocery store to buy rubber gloves, trash bags, a gallon of bleach, some Mountain Dew, because you need fuel apparently, and a pack of gum. When he returned, he found the knife set in the kitchen and put a large butcher knife and a pair of shearing scissors on the bathroom counter, along with the items he had just bought. He then went in the living room and dragged Jane's body into the bathroom. She weighed about 170 pounds, so he couldn't just pick her up. When he got her into the bathroom, he took her clothes off, except for her underpants. He stripped down to his boxer shorts and tank top, and that's when Matthew returned to the apartment. Jason told him, just go in the other room and don't come out until I come get you. During the next couple of hours, Jason was with Jane's body in the bathroom. The first thing he did was he grabbed her body, placing her waist over the bathtub's ledge so that she was positioned so her legs were outside of the tub and her face touched the inside of the tub wall. She kind of bent over the side. Jason first cut off her hair, leaving her neck exposed. Then he got the butcher knife and began to saw Jane's head from her body. At the first sight of blood spilling from her neck, he threw up in the toilet until his stomach was empty. Eventually, he was able to remove her head and her hands. And he drained a lot of blood out of her body. I mean, she pretty much didn't have any blood left. The boys wrapped up Jane's body in a sleeping bag and loaded it into their car. That's when they drove to that neighborhood where the security guard, Pete Martinez, was.
And they told him to fuck off. He's just a security guard.
Yes. So that was plan A. They were going to dump her in that neighborhood. Instead, they ended up having to dump her over the side of the highway into a ravine. And that's where the police eventually found her body.
Where'd they find her head and hands?
Well, after dumping her body, they went back to the apartment. Jason set to clean up. There was a bloodstain on the carpet where Jane had died, and he tried to get it out, but it never came completely out. He ended up buying a throw rug later and covering it up. He drenched the bathroom with bleach and cleaned every spot. What they did with her head and hands was, after they dumped her body, they put them in a duffel bag and put the bag in the coat closet in the apartment.
That's not a good solution.
No, it's not a good solution. Matthew didn't find out that Jason had cut off Jane's head and hands until the next morning when he saw a news report on the TV, like, saying this body was found. Then he was like, oh my fucking God. He demanded to know what had happened. He confronted Jason. Jason said, just don't touch the duffel bag in the closet.
Oh, okay.
Because he was trying to figure out what to do with it.
What did Matthew think he was doing in the bathroom?
I know, right?
I'm just curious.
Exactly. That's what I want to know.
I'm sure none of them are thinking rationally throughout any of this.
No.
Clearly.
Exactly. For the next couple of weeks, I don't think it lasted very long. The boys did live a very blissful life. They told their friends that Jane had left town to visit family, and they had friends over, like, for the first time in their lives. They were able to have friends over. They were eventually caught when the report made by the security guard, Pete Martinez, finally landed on the detective's desk in charge of the investigation.
Well, because he got the license plate.
Yes, he got the license number. Plate. So it didn't take them long to figure out what had happened. And Jason eventually confessed. He did try to protect Matthew, saying, I pretty much did everything. Jason Bautista was convicted of first-degree murder in the killing of Jane. His half-brother, Matthew, who was only 15 years old when Jane was killed, testified for the prosecution, saying he didn't help kill his mom, but helped dispose of her body. He pleaded guilty to being an accessory to murder and was sentenced to the 749 days he had already been in jail. And then he was freed. So he's out.
I hope he got some therapy.
God, I hope so. So Jason is still in prison. And
what did he get?
25 to life.
25 to life.
Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't tell you that. He got 25 to life. The information I got for this podcast was I read a book. It was called Such Good Boys by Tina Durman. And it does go into a lot more than I've told you here, but it was a pretty good book. I enjoyed reading.
Right.
And that's why I told you I have a lot of conflicted feelings because while Jane didn't deserve to be murdered,
I felt bad for those boys.
I felt bad for the boys. I felt bad for her because she obviously suffered from mental illness and it would have probably turned out completely different if she had been treated.
And there were alternatives for those boys.
Yes.
I mean, Jason was an adult.
Yes.
He could have done something different. I'm sure there were options out right. there. Maybe not good ones, but better than this. Right.
He already lived in his car and in a hotel. It's not like that was what was going to happen. He'd already been there. I mean, I don't know. You're right. There could have been many better options.
This goes in the pisser category.
Yeah.
Life's a pisser.
Life's a pisser, man.
And so is this story.
Absolutely. Talia, I'd like to mention that this case was recommended by a listener, so we would like to thank Nicole for suggesting this case.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you, Nicole. And before we go, we have some shout-outs.
Shout-outs. Love shout-outs. These shout-outs are for our newest members of Patreon and our Apple podcast channel.
We would like to thank Kelsey S., Gloria H., Brandy M., Agnes H., Roisin M., Jason K., Raven L., Kathleen B., Die Land Lust.
What? Die Land Lust.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Zoe F.
Wonder if that's her stage name.
I know. Cami E., Chelsea, Nicole B., Dave M., Christina F., Casey with a K., Robin M., Beverly S., Donna, Rachel B., Tammy J., Emerald, Quentin S., Amy N., Roberta P., Duane S., Jennifer S., Lindsay, Michelle A., Andrea V., and we'd like to thank our Apple subscribers, Carolyn, Kelly with an I, Ruth, Michelle M., Abby, Leah, and Jordan.
Jordan.
But you know who you are.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much.
And one very important shout out. We would like to give a shout out to Harry, who made some beautiful keychains for Talia and I.
Yeah, he personalized them for us, and it was very sweet of them.
They're lovely. So thank you so much, Harry.
Yeah, I absolutely love them. So thank you.
Thank you. If you would like to become a Patreon subscriber, please go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/TNTCrimes. You can subscribe to our Apple channel. They both have the same episodes by just going to your Apple Podcast app. And click the subscribe button. They'll charge you through Apple Pay.
It's easy peasy.
It's so easy.
It is harmless.
You can find us on social media, on Facebook and Instagram at Hardcore True Crime.
You can go to our website and see pictures regarding all of our episodes, crimesandconsequences.com. You also get information on being a member. And some of the perks of being a member are ad-free episodes. Nobody wants those ads.
Nobody wants them.
I mean, we want
ads. Of course, we want ads.
We are not getting paid for ads, but...
You don't want to listen to them.
You get early releases, and there's like 170 exclusive episodes for special, amazing people such as yourself.
And there are levels. So the highest level where you get all the episodes is being a first-degree member.
Yep.
So check out the levels, whatever works in your budget.
Either way, we so appreciate you guys for taking the time to listen to us.
Well, thank you, Talia, for listening to this week's episode. And until our next one,
try not to kill each other.
Bye.